From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, the trauma of war. Australian troops have been fighting alongside American, British, and other coalition forces in Afghanistan for nearly 18 years now, since late fall after the attacks of September 11th, 2001.
We will stand by them. We will help them. We will support actions they take to properly retaliate in relation to these acts of bastardry.
At least 43 Australian soldiers have died there over the years. And like other veterans of combat, among those who made it home, many have suffered emotional trauma over things they did, saw, or had done to them on the battlefield.
Your worst enemy is your own head. Eventually, the anxiety turns to anger, and you slowly become a person that you don't want to be in.
A new fictional feature film in Australia called Jirga explores that trauma by focusing on one Australian soldier struggling with remorse over his killing of an Afghan civilian. The soldier returns to Afghanistan hoping to offer an apology to the family.
I'm here to confess. We did a raid on a village. I killed one of your brothers. That money's for them.
The film's director, Benjamin Gilmore, is our guest today.
Let's start with a really basic question. How did you decide to tell this story?
I think this is an important story to tell, and I had not previously heard of any stories where soldiers or former soldiers had gone back to the battle zone as civilians in order to find the family of civilians they've killed and apologize to them or interact with them. I'd certainly heard of tales of veterans returning to Vietnam. In Australia, we have veterans returning to East Timor to find some kind of healing and to interact with the locals and create some kind of understanding and healing post-conflict. But so far, nothing from Afghanistan. And what struck me was the fact that there are in Australia and in the UK and obviously in America, vast numbers of veterans who have served in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere who are living with physical and mental injuries from their experiences. And some of them with lives completely torn apart by these experiences, alcoholism, drug abuse, living on the streets, broken marriages, and tragically, a high rate of veterans taking their own lives. We have a similar issue in Australia. I think in America, it's on average about 20 veterans a day that take their lives, which is horrendous. And so this weighed on me with my experience in health. I'm a qualified paramedic and work in public health. So I've had a lot of contact with veterans who've served and I'm well aware firsthand of their pain and their lives that have been destroyed. At the same time, I've spent quite a bit of time over in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, in the border regions, in the federally administered tribal areas and the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, hearing stories of the fallout from the war in Afghanistan and the impact on the civilians, on the Pashtuns, on Afghans of every ethnicity. And so I just, having been exposed to both the impact on civilians and on combatants, I felt compelled to make a film that would be a comment on that and offer not just a comment on the tragedy of that, but a way towards healing, some kind of blueprint for peace and what was possible to bring a healing post-conflict.
We should give a really brief and broad schematic of the plot of the film, if you don't mind, and also remind us the film is fiction.
Correct. The film is fiction. It's the story of a former Australian soldier who was involved in a night raid, a joint raid with the Americans in a village in Kandahar. And during that raid, accidentally, inadvertently shot and killed an unarmed civilian. And then has been tormented by the guilt of that action and decides, instead of going down the path of destroying himself, allowing this guilt and these thoughts to destroy his life. We imagine him to be at that point where he had a choice between taking his life or doing something radical like buying a ticket to Afghanistan, which he did to go back on a tourist visa to track down the family of that civilian and to apologise and then face the tribal court, the Jirga, and his fate in their hands.
He goes through a number of trials, in addition to the fact that a number of Afghans that he meets when he first arrives don't want to drive him towards the region that the Taliban controls.
Correct. There is obviously a reluctance that he faces from Afghans to go down to Kandahar when he gets to Kabul. And that's mainly due to the danger aspect. There are some provinces in Afghanistan that are still very unstable. And Kandahar, Helmand, these places are still very volatile, as was Nangarhar province, where we shot most of those scenes. You know, we faced a very similar kind of parallel reluctance as filmmakers there from the Afghans who collaborated with us to travel to Nangarhar to make this film because of those dangers. They took that risk in the end because they really believed in this story and the importance of the story reaching the outside world. And so, you know, in terms of courage, in terms of the bravery, people often talk about our courage and bravery in going to Afghanistan and doing this, but really it was the Afghans we collaborated with who arguably were the most courageous because of their collaboration with foreigners. I mean, it's a huge thing over there. They're very suspicious of the intention of Westerners at this point in time.
You were actually originally going to film in Pakistan. What happened?
We had some funding that was promised to us by a Pakistani Pashtun businessman who was going to put up the whole finance for the film. He hadn't done his due diligence there with permissions and permits from the authorities, namely the Inter-Services Intelligence Public Relations Branch, who are very, very powerful in Pakistan. They pretty much run the place. And when they finally came to reading the script, they deemed it too politically sensitive and they banned us from making it in the country. And that's the point where the businessman withdrew his money. And so we were left in this safe house in Islamabad with no finance and being harassed by agents of the Inter-Services Intelligence. And so we faced a choice whether to return home with nothing or to carry on with a plan B that I had up my sleeve, which really amounted to little more than a couple of phone numbers of some Afghan producers and actors. And we decided, I guess, in the spirit of the Afghans who don't let very much defeat them, that we needed to forge on and give this a go in Afghanistan. So we bought two tickets to Kabul and purchased a camera and decided to make the film on the fly in Afghanistan with very little money and without that original support that we had.
And I read that there are actually former members of the Taliban who are among the crew and the actors themselves.
Sure, we had a few former members. Majority of our Afghan collaborators had lived under Taliban rule. Some of them had joined the Taliban as youngsters. I mean, it was at one time quite a tempting thing for adventure-seeking young, you know, teenage boys to join up. But I think as far as our non-actors, they really didn't. Their passion for film and for acting and music and in the arts didn't really align with Taliban ideology, so they ended up leaving the group. But the advantage of employing men who had been a part of the Taliban was that when they were playing Taliban in the film, you get a very authentic performance because they had been part of the group, they know how to speak and act and dress like Taliban. So we also involved them in the continuous development of the story in order to achieve the authenticity that we were after with this film, Jirga.
How much of the film was scripted?
Well, there's a scripted through line that was there from the beginning and never really changed. But what changed along the way was things that we were informed about by locals. There were scenes that were removed because they were not deemed to be authentic. There was dialogue that was added by Afghans we were working with because it was more realistic. There was dialogue that was taken out. So it was a constantly changing screenplay. And we were open to that. There's no point in making a film in a country like Afghanistan where you have the opportunity here to shoot in the real locations with people who've lived those lives or lives very close to the characters without being open to their contribution. And so it became a very kind of team approach that we had and a very collaborative. And that the spirit of that collaboration was felt all through the shoot, and it gave us moments in the film that were happy accidents and true magic because of things that you could never script from 10,000 kilometres away. You had to be on location.
Can you give me an example of one of those?
Sure. I mean, there's a lot in the film that adds flavour of the world that we were in. So on one occasion when our band of Taliban were walking through the mountains towards where they park their motorbikes because they were going to take the hostage, our protagonist, who is kidnapped halfway through the film, and they're going to take him to another location. And some boys from the local village were using slingshots to hit a plastic bottle in the desert, and it's the game they play. And so they were just happened to be doing that on location. And so I started filming that. And we had a lot of, you know, security issues, time pressures and so on. But I felt it was very important that we didn't only get the necessary scenes and dialogue that was in the script, but also these little cultural elements that put you in that world. And so little moments like that of kids using slingshots and bottles just really add to that feeling that you're right there in Afghanistan. This is not a film that's faked in any way. We see so many films about the Afghan war, not so many, but there's been plenty where, you know, it's shot in Nevada or even Morocco, and it doesn't feel quite real.
What kind of security issues did you run up against?
In Nangarhar province, there is a presence of Islamic State, Khorasan, province, the ISKP, the Division of Islamic State, known locally as Daesh. So we had threats from IS. In fact, on one occasion, our shoot day was cut short because we had the agents that were with us, the security forces that were with us, picked up two men coming out of the cave complex in which we were shooting. There are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of caves and cave complexes around Jalalabad, all the way up to Tora Bora. And we were shooting in one of these on the outskirts of Jalalabad. Two men were detained coming out of one of them about midday one day. We were on our third day shooting there. And there was a suspicion that they belonged to Daesh and that they had been planting an improvised explosive device for us in the caves. These are the kind of threats that we were exposed to. For me personally, I was more worried about friendly fire. I was worried about the fact that we were traipsing over these mountains with actors dressed like Taliban, carrying AK-47s, and those mountains around Jalalabad have got a lot of surveillance on them from US drones and from a Afghan blimp that's on the outskirts of town that's constantly looking out for unusual activity. So the fear of being hit by a Hellfire missile or a gunfire from a gunship helicopter or something was all pervasive and was always there. That's what worried me most of all.
How did the other Afghans receive you other than, I mean, you talked about threats you received, but how did Afghans receive you and the script, this idea of an imagined reconciliation?
They were extremely hospitable. I found the Afghans to be warm, friendly, optimistic about their future despite everything, despite all the negativity. They still have hopes that things are going to improve and improve soon. They were very kind to us and welcoming. And it wasn't an automatic type of hospitality, I felt, because they have time and time again found that Westerners have kind of done things in their country that they've taken exception to and let them down. And I think it took a little while for them to realise that our intentions were noble. And once they believed in what we were doing and once they took part in it and took some ownership over this story, they really threw their heart and soul into what we were doing.
You don't translate all the time when the Taliban is speaking. Why did you make that choice?
We really wanted the audience to be in Mike's head, Mike being the protagonist, the Australian soldier going back. We really wanted the audience to take his point of view, and he didn't understand any Pashto. And so it was important for us that the audience didn't have an unfair advantage of knowing what the locals were saying. Many of us who've travelled, many of your listeners who've travelled to these places would know that sometimes you're in situations where the locals are talking about you, often in very heated, in a heated way, and you're not sure whether they're talking about what to cook you for dinner or whether to sell you off as a hostage. So we really wanted the audience to feel a little bit of that anxiety that the lead character feels in those moments. So we withheld subtitling up to the most crucial point about midway through the film, where we felt the audience really needed to know what was going on at that point.
When did you start going to Afghanistan?
During the making of my first film, Son of a Lion, which I shot in the tribal areas of Pakistan, this was in 2004, I crossed over by motorbike with a friend, you know, without a visa or a passport. Then in 2013, I went on a reconnaissance mission there. It was just on a tourist visa and travelled to some of these locations and to see what was possible. So I had a little bit of travel experience there. I'd been reading plenty about the travels that many young people took through Afghanistan in the late 60s and 70s on the Overland Trail, the hippie trail. I was obsessed with the hippie trail for a while, I guess mostly out of jealousy for not having been young at that time and had the opportunity to travel that route myself back when Afghanistan was, you know, a lot easier to travel through. And that's how I found out about Banda Amir, these fabled lakes just outside Bamiyan, which are simply beautiful, the most beautiful part of the world I've ever visited. And I promised myself when I visited there in 2013 that I would do my best to put these lakes on screen in a film, because they were just so spectacular, and share them with the world because I love them so much. And so there are scenes in the film on these lakes that many people have seen Jerga mention and often speak about.
Well, it's a dreamlike moment in the film, in no small part because the driver and your protagonist are in a kind of beat-up looking pink swan boat of sorts in this sort of surreal setting that looks like it's, you know, a scene, you know, a cut scene from The Little Prince or something. It seems like something out of a dream.
A bit incongruous, yes. And that's what we wanted to convey as well. I mean, here you have a country with incredible, you know, natural biodiversity. It's, you know, there are something, hundreds and hundreds of more plant and vegetable species than endemic to the country than Europe, you know. It's really a spectacular country from a nature point of view. And when you do talk to Afghans about the many reasons why they continue to fight off, you know, foreign invasions and occupations, a lot of it comes back down to their love and passion for their country, and not just what the country represents, but the natural beauty of the country that they don't want tainted. And you hear Afghans speaking about it in that way, how they want to protect their land, protect the beauty of it, and that's part of why they fight. So in Jerga, it was really important to us and to our Afghan collaborators that we showcase some of that natural beauty.
Why did you feel driven to tell this story? You're not a former service member, unless I'm wrong, but no. What do you feel the responsibility is of Australia or Western powers who've served in Afghanistan?
Well, I think it's important that I inspire with film empathy in other people. So I think film is an exercise in empathy, and I think that's something we have lost a lot of in our political system. I think it's really important that we come back to, you know, showing the humanity of people that have been reduced to statistics. I also think that many war films that we have seen over the years, especially the blockbuster kind of big Hollywood war films, historically have been about physical courage, how well you can fight and shoot and kill an enemy. And I think in real life that has not actually gone so well for Western forces in countries like Afghanistan in these wars. And I was more interested in exploring the notion of moral courage of a soldier going back and getting down on his knees and apologizing to the family of a civilian that he killed, and that is demonstrating true masculine courage, as opposed to how well we can fight and kill an enemy. Jirga explores restorative justice, you know, and in Afghan culture, especially among the Pashtuns, their traditional code of conduct, Pakhtunwali, within that code, there is an ancient tradition of restorative justice. In fact, one of the tenets of Pakhtunwali, known as Nanawati, demands that if a person who has perpetuated a crime against your clan or your family or killed one of your brothers comes to your door and apologizes with genuine remorse, that you are compelled to forgive them, and moreover, you must give them shelter, bring them in, feed them, and protect them with your life. And I find that very interesting, that is built into that culture, this restorative justice. So there's a lot we don't know about Afghan culture that to me is a blueprint to peace and what is possible. So I guess this story for me is about what could be, a reality that could be a way of achieving peace and healing.
How has it been received by service members in Australia?
We've had quite a few veterans in Australia see the film. It's been received very positively, particularly by veterans who have been affected negatively by their experiences, which amount to quite a few. You know, and I think there's something in this. I mean, we've got a lot of evidence about exposure therapy being beneficial for veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder. And I guess there could be nothing better, in my view, than going back into that conflict zone and experiencing it in a different way. You know, if the only memory of Afghanistan you have as a soldier is the killing and being in situations of enormous fear for your own life and for the life of your comrades, to go back there and feel as though they are so warm and hospitable, and for that to be a different type of experience of that conflict zone, I think there is something in that that is worth exploring.
One of the things that's striking in the film is that the Taliban say to him, why this one killing? There has been so much killing. Why find restitution for this one killing? What do you think the answer of the character would be?
And in fact, that's a question asked by the Taliban commander in the caves of the captive veteran who returns. I think it's a very, very valid question. But, you know, the difficulty is, and there have been enormous mistakes made by soldiers in the field, but it's very I think it's very unfair to be too hard on soldiers in that moment. And I have spent some time with veterans and soldiers who are still serving who have told me that of the frustration that they have felt being placed in situations where they discover that the intelligence is bad, which it so often is, and then they're in a village, often at night, and they have local tribesmen defending their village and their homes, their families, and soldiers having to fight their way out to protect themselves and their their fellow soldiers just to survive, and the frustration of those moments. And in the heat of the battle, things happen. You're being fired at from a compound, you know, you throw a grenade in and it turns out there are women and children in there. I think for me, having spoken to veterans and Afghans in these villages who have suffered the impact of some of these night raids, you know, we shouldn't have been there in the first place. I think that's the only way to really truly prevent these kind of tragedies from happening.
Do you have a moral thought on the Western role in these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq then?
Well, I do. I think for the most part, they're counterproductive. It certainly has been in Afghanistan. The US government overestimated its ability to build and reform the government there and the institutions. And this came out in the SIGAR report, the Inspector General's report on Afghanistan recently, that the stabilization efforts were not tailored to the Afghan context well enough, and that a lot of the money that was put in to try to achieve these quick gains just exacerbated some of the problems and the corruption and so on, which made the conflict worse in so many regions. So just speaking to Afghans, and this includes Afghans of every ethnicity that were part of our crew, and women who were also part of our cast and crew, they all asked me to pass on the message that they are fed up with foreign interference and that they are ready and willing to manage their own affairs and to deal with those local threats in their own way, and that they want to be left in peace. And so I guess that's part of the message of the film as well.
Benjamin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sarah, for having me.
That was Benjamin Gilmore, director of the film Jirga. First Person is produced by me, Sarah Wildman, along with Benjamin Soloway and Maya Gandhi. Our editor is Rob Sachs. Our executive editor for news and podcasts is Dan Efron. If you like this episode, please subscribe. We'll be back next week.